The following presentation was recorded at Renewing the Anarchist Tradition on Saturday, September 25th, 2004, and it's entitled Flagging, Fornicating, and Foyer, Emma Goldman's Glimpse into the Limitless World of Sexual Harmony, and the presenter was Hilton Bertillon.
Whenever I mention Goldman or VA, no one really generally seems to know, even people that are interested in anarchism, either have kind of heard of Goldman or not really interested in Goldman or heard that, you know. I had one person actually who was somewhat of an academic mentor, I guess, until we met once and suggested that they couldn't find any value in Goldman's work, and all that they could find, and they tried and tried and read and read, was who's sleeping with who. So even people that I thought were interested in anarchism, and people like Goldman, were still really sort of devaluing their work and weren't really all that interested. So I was really interested in just kind of hanging out and hearing what other people have to say that are actually interested in reading or Goldman and or global justice movements and what sort of connections other people are making, if any. As the 19th century's complete utopian, Fourier's social criticism was founded on justice, equality, liberty, etc., but rather on pleasure. Therefore, all institutions and moral imperatives that in any way can find or judge one's pursuit of such pleasure were to be challenged and consequently destroyed. Pleasure for Fourier could be the binding element of human society. The ideal society should, therefore, be one that allows for the free expression of all passions without the constraining force of morality and social judgment. Salvation, argued Fourier, could only come from a range in the social environment, from a utilization of the passions. Such expression was, for Fourier, an affair of the state. One must keep in mind that when Fourier refers to the state, he is speaking the general collective. The boundary between public and private would become extinct. The opening up of one's passions would allow, in fact, demand that they be expressed in public. Thus, while Fourier was deeply concerned about the freedom of the individual, the basic unit of his theory was, in fact, the collective. Fourier even went so far as to argue that, quote, all sexual activity and harmony is what he called, was the phalanx, like his utopia, would be carried out in the open. He even suggested that monogamous couples that had the nerve and audacity to have sex within closed doors and like their own bedroom would be dragged from their beds in the middle of the night and publicly humiliated. Because that essentially was the slap in the face of the collective, of the group, of society, to close yourself off like that and close off your pleasures and make it exclusive and monogamous. With the total acceptance and consequential classification of one's sexual desires, one's community becomes an element of their expression. Passions are no longer considered private affairs encroached upon by society and its institutions, but rather inner desires that may be allowed to find expression with a community acceptance that does not demand the self-discipline of its inhabitants. In fact, to ensure such expression and harmony, all adults would be entitled to a satisfying minimum of sexual pleasure. For Fourier, sexual fulfillment in society could be paralleled with the desire for both income and food. In regards to the latter, Fourier asks, when food is lacking, the people will overthrow the government. Why not too with sexual frustration? Despite incredibly anarchistic features, Fourier possessed a very particular vision of harmony in its institutions. One of the most striking and arguably disturbing elements of harmony inspired a title of an essay called Sexual Harmony or Candyland. Fourier suggested that bread lose its distinction as the quote emblem of need and thus become a luxury food. Therefore, man's pivotal nourishment must be not bread, but sugared fruit. Fourier is, however, quick to dispel concerns of such a diet by pointing out that, quote, we can counterbalance sugar's warming influence with a great abundance of alcoholic wines. All our present-day knowledge of hypodrive semen and diabetes allows us to find humor in the absurdity of such a proposal. Fourier's gastronomic abstraction serves also as a more illuminating example of the problematic nature of her general utopian ideal. Numbering approximately 1,600 people, the ideal community or phalanx was to be established by a wealthy benefactor. While variety was to be the essence of phalansterian life, an average day in harmony was quite long and regimented. An average day in harmony is filled with work, eating, and erotic activities. The overseeing of the erotic activity was done by what Fuyang titled the Court of Love, consisting of high priests, pontiffs, matrons, confessors, fairies, fuckers, and genies. The Court of Love was both a judiciary body and a recreational institution, whose purpose it was to both organize bets, entertainments, orgies, and the enforcement of a minutely detailed amorous code. Fuyang went even further to ensure the sexual gratification of harmonians by proposing experienced and energetic young women known as Bichons and the aptly titled Handsome Couple. The Handsome Couple was, Fuyang suggested that in every community, every society, there always seemed to be people that were more attractive than everyone else, but nobody ever got to sleep with them because the two pretty people would end up hooking up and they'd be an organism. So he suggested that in the ideal community, we would find the most attractive people in the two, and then they would become public sex workers. So then everyone in the community got to enjoy the most handsome people, and they didn't go off and be exclusionary.
Bummer if they were lousy sex.
Bichons were like
public
sex workers. And then there was also the handsome couples and the something else. This argued beauty was unfair to all those who desired to be with such beauty but could not. Therefore, in the interest of the community, such a couple would be available for all. The predetermined vision of Fuyang, and in fact, any utopian thinker, is problematic for a number of reasons. He's actually storing a Muscovite princess. So he tells this story. Dame Stroganoff, a Muscovite princess, seeing herself grow old, was jealous of the youth and beauty of one of her slaves. She frequently had her tortured, and she herself often struck her with pins. What was the real motive of her cruelty? Was it truly jealousy? No, it was lesbianism. Without knowing it, this lady was a lesbian, in love with the beautiful slave whom she tortured. So he basically suggested that all frustrations and anger and bitterness and everything was kind of bad in the world was basically due to sexual frustration. And that if it found its ideal realization in a sort of limitless world of sexual expression, then everything would be okay. He also suggested armbands, which is an interesting precursor to the practice of flagging, which for those of you who don't know, is the practice of flagging, putting different handkerchiefs in your back pocket, and depending on what you're into. So he suggests that everyone wear armbands that described what everyone was into, and then everyone else would know, and we wouldn't have to go through the confusing process of talking to each other. Asking, what are you into? Yeah.
Boy, all of that seems to contradict your fundamental premise.
And he said, especially for travelers who went into new towns, and the people in the town would know the new person and what they're into, and exactly how the town could fulfill their needs. So the extremely detailed nature of Fuyang's harmony acts as somewhat of a parody, at least for myself, of other prescribed notions. Two, harmony allows us to see how encapsulating and regimenting a utopian vision may become, despite the pluralist principles on which it stands. Regardless of the freedom, choice, and supposed liberation of its inhabitants, harmony, as well as any other predetermined normative vision, by its very nature, imposes itself on those within it. Third, while harmony may seem more extreme than other visions in its theory, principle, and general structure, they are actually quite similar. While this paper is a critique of such an action, one must admire both the bravery and madness of supplying such a detailed account of a perfect society. As well, Fuyang's concern for sexual expression and desire, and to reconceptualize and play with sexuality, space, community, and the divide between public and private, I think is something that I admire. To possess the answers regarding the ideal social structure of human nature and the most beneficial world of social relations allows little, if any, room for questions. Fuyang stated quite honestly that he has, quote, no desire to engage in any polemic argument on the subject. While some may be open to more debate regarding their conceptions of Fuyang, little can be done to convince them to release all foundational conceptions on which their vision stands. Such thinkers speak as Candide, convinced that it's, quote, the new world that's the best of all possible worlds. to prescribe, invent, structure, and consequently dictate one's conception in which all else must reside, to present oneself as a seer to whom we must refer if we desire the answers to our happiness. The good society, as Barclay points out, is that which does not purport to know what such is, but rather realizes that the battle is forever. Both challenging Fourier and potentially becoming the subject to those who attempt to impose a similar description is what I would tentatively call cruel justice movements. Contradicting arguments that a large portion of participants within the movement have uncritically accepted the label, Kalinikos and others have argued that the label anti-globalization is a fact, that many in the movement have rightly distanced themselves from its name. The suggestion that the movement is against globalization does not do justice to groups and individuals who speak passionately of global justice and the making of a global community. While opposed to global exploitation, global capitalism, global imposition, and corporate globalization, the movement so frequently defined as anti-globalization is arguably more important in its dynamic makeup and thought than those that impose such a label. As Hart and Negri point out, quote, "It is pro-globalization and that it seeks to eliminate inequalities between rich and poor, and between the powerful and powerless, and to expand the possibilities of self-determination." Of all the labels that have been applied to the movement, none have fallen under more deserved scrutiny and speculation than the anti-globalization title. The misleading and inapplicable suggestion, such a loaded term, has been rejected by those who are in fact fighting for more global thought and action. To speak of a movement, a structure, a character, however contradictory or problematic, may arguably safely be done so long as the recognition exists regarding the importance for non-encapsulating the discourse and the openness for an equally diverse and inclusive view. For instance, when Marcos speaks of one no and many yeses, he's not suggesting that there's an agreed upon agenda or direction of the movement, but rather a spirit or common ethic that manifests itself in a diverse range of tactics, locations, politics, and concerns. Terms such as love, justice, freedom, democracy, autonomy, community, solidarity, while employed by some to prescribe specific intentions, not only of themselves, but a direction of politics that should be employed by everyone in the movement, are used in an attempt to communicate, however difficult and at times impossible, the sense of concern shared by so many people. So, and then go on and talk generally about the movement. But I kind of want to quickly talk about how I see it, its sort of spirit. So what I would call the structuralist structure of the movement comprised primarily of locally and nationally based groups. They most appropriately be understood as a quote network of communities or quote loosely connected networks, similar to Deleuze and Guattari's concept of the rhizome. The rhizome, according to Deleuze and Guattari, has no points or positions, as one finds in a structure, tree, or root. Instead, it is characterized not by centralized character, order, or control, but rather multiple lines of flight, which within, quote, acentered systems, networks, a finite automata, where communication occurs between any two neighbors, where channels or links do not pre-exist. What is most important for this project is the spirit of a movement that, like the rhizome, has no central authority or pre-existing direction, project, or control. As in the case of with global justice movements, the rhizome is an acentered system, non-hierarchical and non-signifying. The rhizome is a, quote, a map and not a tracing. Such a map is open, connectable in all its dimensions, and capable of being dismantled, is reversible and susceptible to constant modification. Global justice movements are, I would suggest, similar to such a map. The multiple networks, geographical locations, connections, tactics, and political positions within the movement allows for a complicated and acentered movement in the truest sense of the term. As has been clear up to this point, the movement of the movement is not a singular directed motion with a fixed goal or endpoint, but rather a movement with multiple and diverse forces fighting for a similar but not identical cause. The motives, tactics, and directives may differ, while the general rubric under which they operate may be quite similar. Social movements have regularly been classified as a unified force with a particular intention and central force from which such directions operate. The question asked of such social movements, and thus the answers willingly provided, neither apply to global justice movements, nor to the developing understanding of it. All questions regarding direction, origin, and specific attention are, as David was in guitar, suggest useless questions, because they imply, as I said earlier, a false conception of voyage and movement. The movement, as David and Guattari classify the rhizome, is the furniture we never stop moving. Such perpetual movement and mobility be clearly encapsulated and identified as being the suggested strength and source of hope for the movement and thus far in this work. What is also a major concern for this work is the effect of controlling or centralizing such a system. As David and Guattari suggest, when a rhizome is blocked, turned into a tree, it's over. As this paper also points out, such a statement, as well as the lessons which may be learned from Goldman, is of drawing danger in controlling, classifying, encapsulating, and centralizing a system that exists against such forces. To recognize the character of such a system, only to desire its control and centralization, is to fail not only to truly understand its unique worth and power, but also to render it incapacitated to turn into a tree. Speaking in 1973, Deleuze suggested that the revolutionary problem today is to find some unity in our various struggles without falling back onto the despotic and bureaucratic organization of the party or state apparatus. This paper suggests that global justice movements have succeeded in finding some unity in both what it fights against and what it fights for, while avoiding the traditional trappings of a singular reliance upon a specific party line, state apparatus tactic, vision, goal, or geographical pattern. It has, I would suggest, found some unity without relying upon a single unity from which all tactics, politics, visions, and movements must stem. The movement, I argue, is scattered, fluid, moving, and multiple nomads that Deleuze suggests are capable of escaping the code with a nomadic community. I also use one additional concept to help understand the argument for a non-hierarchical, non-strict, contradictory, rhizomatic, and ever-changing movement is Lao Tzu's The Way. His work, Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu similarly speaks of a thing that in fact has no singular source or logic. According to Lao Tzu, the way is a form of thinking, acting, and being which acts with purpose and direction while simultaneously recognizing the singular, finite, and requisite adaptability and fluidity of such movements. For Lao Tzu, water's natural ability to excel in benefiting the myriad of creatures without contending with them, and its willingness to settle where none would like to be, allows it to come closest to the way. Despite such a malleability and refusal to constrict while simultaneously adding and aiding and well-being, Lao Tzu points out that while, quote, there is nothing more submissive and weak than water, for attacking that which is hard and strong, nothing can surpass it. An analogous connection can be made to global justice movements and, as discussed earlier, its concern for social justice in a manner that both allows for a non-paternalistic or condescending relationship and an equal level of humility in allowing for a diversity of tactics, geographical, and political concerns. As is equally evident in The Way, this in itself provides the greatest challenge to dominant, centralized, and stagnant sources of power. What to some appears as a disorganized, fragmented, and ineffective social movement, in fact, draws strength from such a perceived weakness. The ability of the movement to adapt, change, and respond in a diverse manner gives hope for its future erosion of an exploitative and hegemonic empire. The task of challenging and totalizing a hegemonic empire that demands a, quote, far-reaching legitimacy spread out over world space requires a water-like ability and desire to settle in the cracks and crevices that a singular, prescribed, and centralized movement would fail or be unwilling to do. So Goldman, how she fits in. Well, Goldman's famous pronouncement that if I can't dance, it's not my revolution, or is it sometimes spoken, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution, is in fact not her actual words. The exchange that resulted in this kind of phrase is an example of the presumption some anarchists had regarding the expected role of both anarchists and the movement to which they belong. The story of this famous quote originates in a request posed to Alex Kate Shulman, having published books and articles about Goldman and thus considered an authority on our politics. Shulman was asked to provide a friend with a photo and phrase to be embossed upon t-shirts that would be sold in the anti-Vietnam protest in the early 70s. Promised t-shirts at cost, Shulman happily provided a number of passages from Living My Life, from where several quotes could be drawn, with particular emphasis placed upon a certain passage from Goldman's autobiography. When she picked up her t-shirt, she was surprised to find a distinct and unrecognizable quote from each photo. It read, "I can't dance, and it won't be your revolution." It was quickly apparent that this quote was an abridgment from the story that she had suggested. It might be a particularly fruitful source for understanding Goldman's work. The story itself is arguably even more dynamic and compelling than the famous quote. While the quote communicates a young embrace of freedom and play and social movements, the passage from which it is extracted expresses an indicting commentary on organizations in general, the early 20th century anarchist movement in particular, and Goldman's embrace of a political ethic fighting for freedom, acceptance, justice, and joy. Upon dancing with what was described as, quote, reckless abandon, Goldman was pulled aside at a party in a form that did not behoove an agitator to dance, especially for someone who was on the way to become a force in the anarchist movement. Told that her frivolity would only hurt the cause, Goldman became furious at the suggestion that a beautiful ideal such as anarchism should demand the denial of light and joy. It is first important to point out, as did Goldman, that her loud objections to this response were met with applause mingled with protest. Not everyone in the room felt that a budding anarchist should remain a conservative, non-expressive being, who never acts in terms of personal impulse, but rather with only the group in mind. However, such confrontation illuminates two points: the very resistance to the simple act of expressive joy, and the signal juxtaposition between those who still perceived anarchism as a staunchly serious movement, devoid of individual expression, and those such as Goldman, who envisioned a social movement that thought as a collective acting for a collection of individuals. In other words, an anarchism that envisioned and subsequently fought for the freedom of individual expression, so long as such did not hinder or repress the same freedom of others. The individual was not to be a victim of the collective and vice versa. Unfortunately for many in the anarchist movement at the time, the individual within the movement was to exist solely for that purpose. While the liberation from structurally imposed limitations was a goal for the general population, those such as Goldman were not expected to enjoy such impulsive freedom. Such a confrontation displays not only the battles Goldman would have throughout her life, with both others and herself regarding impulse, expression, joy, and privilege, but also the lived politic to which Goldman subscribed. For Goldman, anarchism was the ideal, the ethic, the politic, and its perpetual circumventing of fixed ideals and goals should in turn be the social, political, and personal compass to which we should all refer. Such an ethic was for Goldman both that which for one should fight and the internal source of struggle and revolt. Anarchism demands not only the right to dance, but the dance itself. For Goldman, anarchism is not only the fight to dance, it is to dance and fight. It's also important to mention that it does not place me in the school of thought who finds little value in Goldman due to it. It's seen as an unnecessary focus by both herself and others upon her personal life. I would respond by suggesting that a great deal of Goldman's value in politics lay in the seemingly everyday or banal events of her life. For instance, Goldman tells the story of in her autobiography about her discussion of Nietzsche that began among some friends, including her lover at the time, Edward Brady. Replying to one friend's assumption that she should not be interested in Nietzsche due to the lack of a palpable political tone in his work, Goldman suggested that such an assumption stems from a lack of understanding toward anarchism and the fact that it embraces every phase of life and effort, and that it undermines the old, outlived values. Goldman further insisted that Nietzsche was not an apolitical aristocratic social theorist, but rather a poet, a rebel, and an innovator. Brady responded to Goldman's passionate insistence upon the political value of Nietzsche by claiming he was a fool with a diseased mind that would soon be forgotten along with his fellow pseudo-moderns. Upon reflection of this event, Goldman would describe it as a month of joy and abandonment that would suffer a painful awakening caused by Nietzsche. This story displays a number of points that this paper is attempting to make. Not only is Goldman's connection to forerunners of post-structuralist thought present, it is a particularly passionate one in which she finds not only philosophical and personal interest in such works, but also their social and political relevance. As well, such a story exhibits Goldman's politics in a situation that may be regarded as yet another diary insertion of a past love and quarrel. The political and theoretical undertones are always present in both Goldman's life and her writings. What may easily be overlooked or disregarded holds the potential value in both the uniqueness of her thought and the internal conflicts dealt with in both past and contemporary movements with regards to the social and political relevance of those with whom activists find inspiration. In short, I'm in a sense simultaneously addressing two schools of thought, demanding that less attention be paid to Goldman's personal life and suggesting that her politics may be found in her writings, and while suggesting that theoretical importance may be found in her life. In other words, for those who find a historical figure in Goldman mostly in her life and letters, I suggest looking closer at her lectures, essays, and books to find her contemporary relevance. Conversely, to those who see little more than a passionate, reactive rhetorician with a flair for propaganda, I would suggest a well-read and thought-out theoretical and political source of such energy. Such diversity of tactics and issues, however, creates a particularly elusive and complex figure. Goldman herself joked to a writer wanting to capture the real Emma Goldman by suggesting that she'd never been able to unearth her. In what was numerous moments in which her Nietzschean influence subtly surfaced, Goldman complained that, quote, the most disheartening tendency common amongst readers is to tear out one sentence from work as a criterion of the writer's ideas or personality. Like global justice movements, Goldman defied simple and clear summary yet possessed a particular logic or focus. Focused upon perpetual thought and action or what's commonly dubbed in Marco's called talking and we walk, Goldman recognized the importance of thought and remained concerned with acting with and for those who suffer injustice. My studies of the movement, wrote Goldman, did not alloy my personal interest in people always stronger with me than theories. Considering the fearless radical politics of Goldman, the fear she instilled in authority and the resonating influence she had upon social movements, both during and after her life, I think we can ask where can such politics be found today. Conversely, we may best start by asking where Goldman would find her kindred spirits. In other words, with what political climates of today would Goldman find herself most sympathetic, aligned, and relevant? It should be clear at this point that the anarchism of Goldman and her insistence upon a collective, inclusive, and diverse politic would find great hope, optimism, and presence in the A-centered, non-hegemonic, and wide-reaching global justice movements. The street theater of mass protests, the direct action of Black Bloc, the playful confrontations of Yabasta, the consensus-driven fight for autonomy and land of the MST, the collective and celebratory spirit of reclaiming streets, and the passionate and poetic resistance of the Zapatistas all share an immense spirit of hope, diversity, and rebellion with the life of Goldman. Essentially, in conclusion, I think through Goldman, we should embrace what Garcia Lorca calls the duende, or the constant baptism of newly created things. The play in Deleuze and Guattari's Rhizome negotiate and explore Gloria Ansel Duda's Borderlands, dance in Emma's Revolution, and most importantly, as the queer anti-capitalist group in Montreal, the Ass Pirates, say, we should all be sluts against capitalism. That's all I have to say.